Thank you, Mr. Wiggins. And ladies and gentlemen, I am delighted to be here. My subject is the crisis of the university, lessons from Cornell.
Let's get the mic to get here.
Louder, please.
I say,
that's right.
My subject is the crisis of the university, lessons from Cornell, the former university, Cornell. Some 15 months ago, I wrote, and this was before the Cornell crisis, I wrote for a conference under the auspices of an organization known as the Public Affairs Conference Center, now located at Kenyon College, but formerly at the University of Chicago. I wrote a paper entitled The New Left and Liberal Democracy. In it, I tried to analyze the essential character of New Left discontent, which I believe to consist in the demand for participatory democracy, a demand made by young men and women who are determined, as they put it, to realize their selves fully. The idea of participatory democracy derives ultimately from the thought of Jean-Jacques Rousseau. The notion of the fully realized self comes from a corrupted version of Nietzsche's thought, expressed among us by some existentialist thinkers and by such men as Erich Fromm. In the paper, written 15 months ago, I showed, or at least tried to show, the incompatibility of these two ideas, namely that it is impossible to have a participatory democracy and fully realized selves at the same time in the same place. Because it is impossible to have a close community, which is what a participatory democracy is supposed to be, when each member of this close community is authorized and indeed is expected to do his own thing, as the current vulgarism has it. And a fully realized self comes down to doing your own thing, this vulgar expression perfectly capturing the essence of this modern idea. I insisted that this incompatibility, however, must not permit the rest of us to minimize the threat posed by this youthful revolution. And at its core, it is indeed a revolution. Because some of these young people are prepared to engage in desperate actions. They display a willingness that stems from the idea that act precedes thought, by which I mean that in the beginning was the act, not the word, that what is important is the act, not the thought or the purpose of the act, and that therefore the authentic person, a term much used among them, the authentic person is one who commits himself to something, commits himself indeed to anything, and is willing to face his opponents, if it comes to that, in a sheer test of wills, that their opponents, that they are tough and committed, and that they see their opponents as soft, flabby, middle-aged, and uncommitted. And I said that we must not minimize the danger, especially because they were partly right with respect to us. Nevertheless, having counseled my readers to take the New Left seriously, I was myself guilty of minimizing the imminence of the danger because, despite my analysis of events, I am ever the optimist, and I exaggerated the capacity among my university colleagues to defend themselves and to defend their institutions. I felt that 15 months ago, just as the New York Times finally got around to admonishing SDS, not when SDS brought Columbia to its knees, but when SDS broke up a meeting being addressed by an editor of the New York Times. James Reston, if my memory serves me correctly. Just as the New York Times found it found itself capable of attacking SDS, so would the university find itself finally able to defend itself when its essential principle was under attack. 6 weeks after the completion of this paper, Cornell showed me how wrong I was. As its title indicates, the paper was concerned with the New Left, which is a term used to cover a variety of groups and a variety of individuals, some Marxists, some Maoists, and some having nothing whatever to do with Marx and Mao. But at any rate, not one of these groups or not one of these individuals is a black. Whereas the crisis at Cornell, in its initial stages at least, was brought on by black students. I have referred to this paper because I want presently to read what I later wrote in an appendix to that paper written after the Cornell event. This appendix has to do with the ability of liberal Democrats, citizens of a liberal democracy, to defend themselves and their institutions. It has to do with adults. And one of the lessons of Cornell, and that's my subject, is that the real malaise among us is to be found not in our young, but in ourselves. The lesson of Cornell, and the lesson we have to learn not only for the sake of Cornell and our universities, but for the sake of our country as well, is the necessity of what I shall call adult rule. The necessity for adults to assume the function that only they can perform. Cornell was not ruled by its adults last year. It was ruled by its students and a few childish faculty members. When the former president of Cornell, president until June of last year, Perkins, came before the throng of some 7,000 or 8,000 students to announce that the faculty had surrendered to the students, he was greeted by utter contempt, or with utter contempt, by the student leaders, and not without reason. Because he is, and I say this with a thorough knowledge of the libel laws, being a constitutional lawyer, utterly contemptible. These students on this terrible occasion proceeded to make it absolutely clear to him that what the faculty had just done, the faculty had been compelled to do by the students. "We clouted Cornell University on the snout," is the way one of the student leaders put it on this occasion. Whereupon the president put his arm around him and said that what had just taken place was one of the most constructive events in the history of the university. They had indeed clouted the university on the snout. Not Perkins's university, but my university. And of course they had been ruling this university for some time. The previous December, December 68, when the president had tried to withhold part of what they had demanded, they, to his face, in an auditorium on the campus, called him every vile name in their vocabulary, and he stood there with that silly grin on his face. Then a month later, during another confrontation, he tried to appease them with a cartload of milk and donuts, something he learned in Public Personnel Administration 101. They tipped over the cart, and in a sense quite properly, and threw the milk and donuts against the wall of the corridor outside his office, and he did nothing. When in another public meeting in February of 69, he tried to defend the university's ownership of Chase Manhattan Bank stock. As it turned out later, he didn't know that the university did not own Chase Manhattan Bank stock. Having just sold it, I presume. They grabbed him by the scruff of the neck, the president of this institution, and pulled him away from the lectern while brandishing a 2x4 over the head of a proctor who tried to come to his assistance. And nothing again was done. When they demanded $2,000 for bongo drums, the vice president for academic affairs announced the fact of this demand at a cocktail party where I was present, and he announced it with a chortle that meant, "You'll never guess what they asked for today." Yet the next day, he and his administrative colleagues scurried about looking for budgets that still had money in them. This was towards the end of the fiscal year. Found these budgets, handed over the money to the students, and also handed over the university's airplane to take them to New York so they could fly there and effect the purchase. When SDS broke into the business school in March of 1969 and broke up a Chase Manhattan Bank recruiting session, the vice president for student affairs, who was a witness to the scene, and it was a very violent scene indeed, said, when asked why he didn't do something, "What else could we do?" The obvious answer, "You could have enforced the law," may have occurred to him, but if it did, neither he nor any of his administrative colleagues on any occasion leading up to the terrible crisis of last April, neither he nor any of his colleagues ever tried to enforce the law. And when the Student Judiciary Board, at the urging of one of my colleagues, a colleague of the faculty, a man who subsequently resigned from the university with me, when the Student Judiciary Board finally did hand down reprimand for those students who had engaged in a series of disruptions that had taken place, and disruptions, incidentally, that I have not bothered to recount here, it was the president who urged the faculty to rescind the punishment and abolish the judicial system. And this was done. As Bayard Rustin put it in an article in this last January's Harper's, and I remind you of the fact that Bayard Rustin, not so many years ago, was regarded as one of the militant civil rights leaders in this country. As he said in this article in Harper's, "Perkins was a masochistic and pusillanimous university president." He was indeed. Unfortunately, he is not unique. But all this is incidental now, however decisive it was last year for Cornell. You do not have to have me tell you that a president of anything should not allow himself to be verbally and physically assaulted by those whom he is supposed to exercise authority over. And generally speaking, you do not have to have me tell you that a university administration ought not to behave as Cornell's administration did last year. To say these things is to utter platitudes. After the event, which was a terrible event, and after I had recovered a measure of the equanimity needed to think and to compose my thoughts, I wrote that appendix to which I referred, and I'd like now to read it. This essay was completed in March 1969, some 6 or 7 weeks before armed blacks and the SDS combined to subject Cornell to the most humiliating experience yet suffered by an American university. The disgraceful capitulation engineered by the administration and accepted with only a minimum of resistance by the faculty requires a reassessment of the prospects for successful revolution in this country. Because the corruption infecting Cornell and the cause of its collapse is by no means confined to Cornell. On the contrary, unless liberals can learn that law, or even law and order, is a cause that decent men can support, what happened to Cornell can happen to this country. Along with others, I too readily assumed that the university, especially one of Cornell's stature, would possess the self-confidence and the vitality necessary to defend itself when faced by clearly outrageous student behavior, and that if necessary, it would not hesitate to meet illegal force with legal force rather than sign the most abject of surrender terms at gunpoint. I was wrong. I was wrong because I had underestimated the extent to which liberal academicians, along with liberals outside the academy, are no longer attached to the principles that are supposed to govern this country and academy. They can therefore view their destruction with a measure of equanimity. Or, if nominally attached to them, to law and due process of law, for example, they are unable or unwilling to defend them. Thus, when confronted by the threat of armed violence, they capitulate. Accustomed to the view that fascism is a phenomenon of the right that appears in the guise of a blustering Italian or a little Austrian corporal with a mustache, they cannot recognize fascism when it speaks in the accents of the left and appears in the guise of black militants and white professors and students with bullhorns. It is this incompetence on the part of adults, more than the ignorance of the young, that is responsible for the perilous state of liberal democracy in this country. It is the job of adults to teach the young, and they are not now doing so. Is it not clear by this time that nothing better characterizes the younger generation today than its unwillingness to recognize the legitimacy of any source of restraint or restraining influence, and that nothing better characterizes adults today than their inability to govern the young? The young today respect neither the law nor their parents and honor nothing that is honorable, and they seem to be utterly without a sense of shame. They therefore attempt to satisfy every appetite and every passion, and their elders do not oppose them. Instead, they are inclined to say that a country that fears its young is sick. How many times have you heard that? Or, when they see them hurling excrement and obscenities at Chicago policemen, they say, "Those are our children out there," as if children could do no wrong. Or, rather than expressing alarm at the extent of deliberate law breaking, they say that, and this is Senator Rivikoff's favorite, "This is the most intelligent and idealistic generation in our history." If anyone is engaged in teaching today, it is the young who are teaching the old, who either join the young in singing the glories of a freedom indistinguishable from license, or lapse into a silence from which they will eventually erupt in a very dangerous manner. Such a democracy is indeed sick, not because it fears its young, but because it is resolved as a matter of principle, or lack of principle, not to fear its young, no matter what they do or declare the intention of doing. Such a democracy cannot defend itself. What the Cornell situation revealed is the ease with which institutions defended by modern liberals can be destroyed. So much for the appendix. What follows is a kind of elaboration. The faculty at Cornell and elsewhere is afflicted with a kind of paralysis of confidence. It dares not defend its own activities, its own institutions. It dares not defend the country, the country's history, the country's enterprises, the country's law. Indeed, it dares not defend its manners, its ways, its hopes, or anything else. They are almost completely bereft of confidence. And whereas they had previously controlled the universities and determined their tone or their style, and of course their curricula, they are now determined, or these things are now coming to be determined, by the young. And too many of the professors, rather than attempt to teach the young, have obviously decided that it is easier to imitate the young, to imitate them in their dress, their style, their manners, their tastes, and of course, their politics. The alternative is to attempt to govern, to lead the young to follow their example, and they lack the confidence to do this. Are there rules against women in men's dormitories? The students want to live together and insist on coeducational, or actually co-sexual accommodations, and they get them. Are there rules against drug use? The students insist that these rules be repealed. And whether or not repealed, they are certainly not enforced. Is there an ROTC unit on campus? Get rid of it. Is it the practice not to permit students to attend faculty meetings? Change it. Who decides the curriculum? The faculty? That will have to change, and forthwith. Are there no students on the boards of trustees? Put them there, or else. Did Cornell yesterday, in the midst of its current crisis, establish a curfew forbidding individuals or groups on campus after 11 o'clock in the evening? 300 to 500 students built a bonfire in the middle of the Arts Quadrangle last night, and they stayed the night, defying the university to enforce its own rule against them. And the university did not even try. Coming up in a week from now is a festival to be attended by 20,000 additional young in Ithaca, New York, the home of Cornell, with rock bands, Jerry Rubin, Dave Dellinger, and the lot. And the occasion is to honor one of our heroes, Father Dan Berrigan, on his way to a federal penitentiary for burning drawers full of draft cards at the Catonsville, Maryland Selective Service Center. He is a fanatic prophet of civil disobedience. Did the university state the case against civil disobedience? Of course not. Did it try to prevent this particular affair? After all, 20,000 additional people in a town of 30,000 people collected with this purpose under the prevailing circumstances at this time might not be the wisest thing to occur. But of course they made no attempt to prevent it. What it did instead was to promise its facilities to place them at the disposal of these people. The local district attorney, incidentally, is somewhat apprehensive. He wondered yesterday in the press conference whether such an assembly might not be a violation of the recent court order that Cornell requested and which the court granted, a court order enjoining disruptions and fires and window smashings and so forth, the sort of things that have been taking place on the campus this week. Now, if the new president of Cornell has the temerity to cancel the festival, we can be absolutely certain that the students will oppose him, and we can be absolutely certain that the faculty will stand with the students. Students rule now. As Plato predicted over 2,000 years ago, democracies will be destroyed by the young. Teachers, he said, will be afraid of their students, and they will copy them. Parents will be afraid of their children, and the regime will collapse in a frenzy of license and radical egalitarianism, and will be replaced by a tyranny, because only a tyranny will be able to reimpose rule, and rule is necessary. The professors, why inveigh exclusively against them? What group outside the university shows any greater strength of purpose? But at least the professors lack confidence, I say. And this lack of confidence displays itself in the confrontation with the young. The young stand on equality and demand it in all things. And how many of us are capable of demonstrating to them that what they are asking for in equal measure, the right to rule themselves, the right to rule the university, and the right to share equally in the rule of the country, that these things are privileges to be earned even in a democracy. Earned if only by growing older, during which time one hopes, or at least it was always hoped, the young would learn to control themselves and thereby deserve to share in the rule of all. The prospect of radical egalitarianism was feared by the greatest of the democratic theorists. It's sufficient to mention here Tocqueville. And their effort was to devise institutions that would somehow stand outside the political arena, stand outside the realm where public opinion would rule, stand outside the realm where the democratic principle, equality, would prevail, institutions that would somehow be able to resist the notion that all opinions are equal, all intelligences are equal, all convictions are equal, all rights to rule are equal, institutions that would somehow reconcile democracy and the achievements of human intelligence and the human spirit. Institutions that would prevent democracy from degenerating into mass democracy. One such institution was understood to be the university, whose purpose in modernity would be to provide a refuge for the calm pursuit of the truth, a refuge from vulgarity, the vulgarity of public opinion, a refuge created by academic freedom and faculty tenure. Academic freedom and faculty tenure would constitute a kind of wall protecting scholars and teachers from political pressures and from public opinion. Then they would teach the young. For example, to refer to my own institution right now, Colgate, the young Charles Evans Hughes, who would then re-enter the political world, better able to serve it as governor, citizen, and model. It is a fact that the professors were able to find the courage to protect themselves and their institutions from the McCarthyite attacks that came from outside the university. But it is unfortunately a fact that the same professors are less capable of defending themselves and their institutions from the attacks that are coming from within the university today, the attacks coming from their own students. The students are insisting that they sit on tenure committees, and they will. They are insisting that they sit on the committees hiring new professors, and they do. They do at Cornell. And for example, they also do at Yale, where a month ago, such a committee with students on it prevented the political science faculty at that institution from hiring the most brilliant young man I have ever had the privilege of teaching. Himself, incidentally, a Yale undergraduate, number one in his class. But this was a long time ago, 5 years. The university, as it was conceived by the founders of liberal democracy, was to save liberal democracy from its own tendencies. It no longer is. And I cannot imagine the survival of liberal democracy without that kind of university. In closing, let me make it clear that in saying we must rule the young, I mean rule them in order that they learn how to rule themselves. Here I'm not referring to SDS, and I'm not referring to other brands of the enragé. These people are beyond us. I'm referring to the others who are still educable, but who desperately need education from us in order to resist the blandishments of SDS and the others. To resist the seemingly attractive and exciting lessons provided by the others, we must demonstrate to this, and I suppose it still is, a decent majority of young, that we know more than they do, that we know more about the curriculum, that we know more about justice, that we know more about history, that we know more about politics, that we know that nothing is easy, that we know that with all its faults, and they are many, and we must demonstrate a willingness to identify them, that with all its faults, this country is still the last best hope of earth. That we know all about these things, and we know more about these things than SDS does. We must convince these others that we do. To rule them, which we must do, we must demonstrate that we deserve to rule them. One last sentence. What Cornell shows, and this again is my subject, is that the young will not accept our rule today under any other conditions. Thank you.